Okay, there.
All right, sounds good. Okay, this is joint work with my colleagues Owen Hoffman, Chris Rosbach, Alex Finn, and my advisor Emmett Witchell. So modern operating system APIs such as POSIX don't give developers sufficient tools to write correct programs in the face of system-level concurrency. The problem here is that there's no concurrency control mechanism for complex operations that span multiple system calls. So in your application, there's fair odds that you might very well have a race condition waiting to happen. And if you do, the bad news is that there's no simple way to fix this problem in your application. So we've got a situation where applications can express consistency requirements to the OS, and the OS can further. So given these problems, we propose system transactions as a way for applications to ensure consistent updates to operating system managed state in the presence of system-level concurrency. System transactions can solve problems, including caused by system-level race conditions, and we can use them to build better applications going forward. So what do I mean by system-level races? Let's start with what's arguably the most famous system-level race, the time of check to time of use race. Now what's going on is we have a root application servicing a request on behalf of the user. And what it's doing is it's checking whether this user has permission to access file foo, and if so, it conditionally opens it and writes it. Now, between this access and open check is a race condition that can be exploited by an attacker to compromise the integrity of the system. And the way this works is if the attacker inserts a symbolic link assembly, it's a system call, between these two calls, and changes the file system namespace to trick this application into modifying the file it shouldn't. We can resolve this race condition using system transactions by wrapping this race-prone code in a transaction. So when the attacker comes along with a symbolic link, the operating system will detect that this is a conflicting operation and will automatically serialize it either before or after the transaction, giving this code deterministic correctness guarantees. In addition to fixing bugs in applications, we can also use system transactions to build better applications going forward. So as an example of this, consider the problem of making consistent updates to stable storage. If you have a fairly simple application, such as an editor, saving a single file, you can probably distill this to a single atomic system call like rename. On the other end of the complexity spectrum, if you have something like enterprise data storage with large data sets and complex queries, databases make a lot of sense. However, there's also this middle ground. If we have something like a user directory service, such as LDAP, that has fairly modest storage requirements, as well as concurrency requirements. And in this middle ground, it's not exactly a natural fit to distill things down to a single rename when you need to save data, and a database introduces a lot of complexity with writing blue code, and as well as just administering a separate system. As an alternative, system transactions can fill this middle ground for applications. The second motivating example for system transactions is transactional software install. Now, the goal of this work is to take something as coarse-grained as an apt-get install, which is the Debian or Ubuntu package manager, wrap it in a transaction, and let the operating system provide features such as automatic recovery from a failed install and consistency across system crashes. Now, there are other solutions to providing these properties for software installation, but none of them solve it precisely, and they all have real usability problems. Some of them don't protect all your files, others have other problems. This is precisely the semantics you want from a software install, but it requires better OS mechanisms. And that mechanism is system transactions. So our implementation of system transactions introduce a very simple API change to the POSIX API, consisting of three system calls, xbegin, xempt, and xabort. What a transaction does is it wraps a series of system calls, and within that transaction, the results of each system call are isolated from other applications on the system until these transactions commit. Now, to get performance in a transactional operating system, you get it from having transactions execute concurrently. However, some transactions cannot both execute safely and at the same time, and must be made to execute serially. A common example of these kind of conflicts is a read and a write from two different transactions at the same time. Now, as I said, because our performance comes from concurrency, we only want to serialize transactions when we absolutely need to. Now, to put this in the context of some related work, first we should note that LS developers really do care about this problem of system-level races and are currently changing the system call APIs to try to resolve these issues. Unfortunately, these solutions tend to have a complex and ad hoc flavor. To address the system-level race conditions we just saw, there have been over a dozen new system calls added to Linux and Solaris in support of letting users take file name resolution out of the operating system and re-implement it in their application. Now, this strikes me as a bit of a regression, because I think that this is what the operating system should be providing for you. Now, for those of you who've been coming to this conference a little longer than I have, you may remember some systems like Quicksilver and Locust that propose and build a very similar abstraction. Now, what these systems did is they took database implementation techniques and applied them to the operating system. In some places, this was a very natural fit. In other places, it didn't quite work out as well, and there were some limitations. So a key contribution of this work is to propose a new approach to building transactions in an operating system that addresses these limitations, upholds strong guarantees, and maintains good performance. Another note is that system transactions are not the same thing as transactional memory. What transactional memory does is it provides a transactional interface to RAM, whereas system transactions are providing a transactional abstraction for system calls at a different layer of the stack. System transactions are not transactional memory, the same way that database transactions are not transactional memory. Now, there are a lot of other related work to this paper that we mentioned, that are listed in the paper, and we're going to move on for the sake of brevity. So having seen some example uses of system transactions, let's now look at the design implementation of our prototype called Texas. So if you're setting out to build a transactional system, you've got to consider essentially three things. First of all, the problem of version management. And this is keeping track of both your new data so that the transaction can commit, as well as your old data so that you can roll the transaction back. And the way that Texas deals with this is by having transactions operate on private copies of data rather than maintaining an undo log. You also need to detect conflicts between transactions, which, in particular, there's a challenge here to minimize the performance impact when transactions do need to be serialized, and to avoid serializing transactions when you don't have to. Finally, you actually need to resolve these conflicts, and a new challenge when you're implementing transactions in the domain of an operating system is serializing, enforcing serialization between non-transactional applications as well as transactional ones. So let's walk through an example of how this all works in our prototype. So here we have two transactions operating on different CPUs. Each are making simple modification to file metadata. One's a chmod of file f, and one's a chown. These are conflicting operations, and the ordering does affect the outcome of the two operations. Now here at the bottom of the slide, we have a representation of an inode for this file. Now this inode is going to look a little bit different than you're used to seeing, because it's split into a header and a data component. Now this is a key implementation technique in Texas, where we take all of the fields that might be modified inside of a transaction and put them in the data component, and then we use the header as a layer of indirection for incoming pointers. With this all in mind, let's walk through our example. So first, CPU 0 will begin its chmod of file f, and the first thing it'll do is it'll acquire a mod for this inode, it'll place an annotation in the header, and then it will make a private copy of this data field, which it will then modify, leaving the shared version in a consistent state. It'll then release its kernel locks and drop back into the user application. When CPU 1 begins its chown of file f, it'll acquire a lock from the same inode header, and it will look for conflicting annotations, which in this case it will find one. So now we've detected that there's a conflict, and we need to ask the OS contention manager what to do about it. The contention manager is a piece of shared kernel code that arbitrates which transaction needs to restart and which one can proceed, based on things like OS scheduling priority. So the contention manager in this case will choose to abort CPU 0's transaction, and will indicate this with a large X. So when CPU 1 proceeds, It'll replace the annotation in the header and make a new private copy based on the consistent shared copy in the middle. There's nothing that prevents this transaction from continuing ahead. For CPU0 to roll back its transaction, it needs to restore its application state and simply discard its private copies of kernel data structures. For CPU1 to commit its transaction, it reacquires the kernel lock for the objects it's seen, and it then replaces the pointer from the inode header to its private copy, essentially publishing this to the rest of the system. It then releases its locks and annotations, and the transaction is committed. So what we've just seen in context, let's compare a little bit with the design of the previous systems in Texas. So what previous systems, including most database implementations, do is they perform speculative writes directly in place on shared data structures. Now, to isolate these writes, they use two-phase locking, and this introduces a problem with deadlock because two-phase locking can ensure that all locks are acquired in the same order. To roll back these transactions, they have to keep an undo lock, and the undo lock introduces problems with priority inversion. Now, what's going on here is if you have a low-priority transaction aborted by a high-priority transaction, both transactions have to wait on the low-priority transaction to put things back in a consistent state. Finally, to commit these transactions, they simply discard the undo lock and release the locks. Texas addresses these performance issues on conflicts by having transactions operate on private copies of data structures, which are isolated. To roll back a transaction in Texas, we discard the private copies, and to publish it, we publish each object with a single pointer slot. In building a transactional system, a key performance concern is minimizing the rate of false conflicts. So what we have here on the screen is what's called a compatibility matrix. And this is a way of representing what kind of accesses can happen concurrently and which ones can't. Now this is the most sort of general and conservative definition of a conflict, which says that you can have multiple readers at a time, but writers have to be serialized with everything else. Now, consider in this context the two transactions here at the bottom of the screen, each of which creates a different file in the same directory. Now, strictly speaking, these are both writes, and according to this definition, they need to be serialized. But if you take a step back and think about what it means to write to a directory, what you're really talking about is adding and removing entries from a set. And if you think about it some more, this is really okay if you're talking about creating different files and neither transaction is reading the directory, because if these transactions execute concurrently, the results will appear the same as if they executed serially. So the insight of this example is that we can leverage object semantics to allow a more permissive conflict definition and therefore increase concurrency in the system. And the way we do this is by supporting precise conflict definitions for each object type. So in the case of a directory, it would look something like this. We can have concurrent readers or concurrent adders and deleters subject to the caveats I just mentioned, and all other sort of concurrent accesses need to be serialized. By doing this, we increase the concurrency in the system without relaxing the isolation and safety guarantees. Another challenge to building a transactional operating system is properly serializing transactions with non-transactional applications. This property is also known as strong isolation. So in Texas, you're going to have a mixture of some applications running transactionally and others, say, system utilities or other applications running non-transactionally. This is a little different than like the context of a database where everything is essentially a transaction. Now, having this property of strong isolation is critical to the overall correctness of the system because it allows incremental adoption of transactions. Now, what I mean is you can take your most important application first, add transactions to it, either to fix a race condition or to increase the concurrency of the application, and it will still work without touching on the other applications. A corollary problem to enforcing strong isolation is the fact that when you're arbitrating a conflict between a transaction and a non-transactional application, you can't roll back a non-transactional system call. And the temptation here is to just always roll back the transaction because it's the simplest thing to do. The problem is that it undermines transactional throughput and overall fairness in the system. So this is something we want to avoid in our design. So let's return to another example in our system. This is our time of check to time of use example from the beginning of the talk, where we have a CPU1 executing the talk to victim inside of a transaction, and CPU0 executing the attacker outside of the transaction. Now we're going to fast forward to the point that CPU1 has done the access chat, but hasn't done the open, and CPU0 is about to execute the symbolic link call. So the first thing that's going to happen in service of this symbolic link is that the kernel is going to get out a lock on the directory entry for tabfoo. Now, having this lock will prevent new transactions from coming along and creating conflicts with this non-transactional system call. This non-transactional call will then read the annotations in the header to identify any conflicts with transactions that have already accessed this call, the directory entry. In which case, of course, it will notice that there's one. So now the contention manager has a choice. We can roll back the transaction on CPU1, but if we don't want to do this, we can also deschedule the non-transactional system call on CPU0. And this is one of the key insights for providing fairness between these two types of calls, is that if you detect a conflict between a transaction and a non-transactional call at the beginning of a critical region, rather than once you're already in the middle of it, you can simply revoke the lock and put the call to sleep inside the kernel using pre-kernel reemption, which is a feature that's been implemented for several years. By using kernel preemption, we're able to fix the overall ensure fairness in the system. All right, so winding this discussion down, one thing that we should mention is that in Texo, system transactions only provide transactional semantics for system state. So if you want to have a transactional programming model in your application, you also need something to manage your application state, which we let applications choose what's the best fit for their needs. One thing Texos provides is copy-on-write paging, which is a fine fit for single-threaded applications, but it doesn't quite work for multi-threaded applications. As an alternative, we describe in the paper how to integrate with user space hardware or software transactional memory, and we allow applications to write their own application-specific compensation code. In simple examples like the time-of-use victim, you can simply put the transaction in a loop until it commits. Finally, in Texos, transactions are a core OS abstraction, and this design principle makes it easy to convert and add transactional functionality to a given kernel subsystem. So considering the example of building a transactional file system in Texos, most of the core transactional functionality is implemented in VFS level code or higher, such as version management, conflict detection, etc. As a result, a specific file system, such as ext3, is only responsible for ensuring atomic updates to stable storage. Now, this is a good design trade-off, because file systems are already good at doing this. So we took the ext3 journaling file system, combined it with our Texos infrastructure, and in one developer month, had a working transactional ext3 prototype. So having gone over the design implementation of the system, let's now turn to evaluation. And I want to answer two key questions. First of all, what is the cost of using transactions in your application? And second, what are the overheads imposed on non-transactional applications running on the same system? As I mentioned, our Texos prototype is an extension of the Linux 2.6 kernel to support system transactions. We added about 9,000 lines of code to the kernel and made minor syntactic modifications to another 14,000. The system runs on commodity hardware and provides transactional semantics for a range of resources, such as the file system, signals, processes, and pipes. Now, there are some absences from this list, including the network and graphics of the device, which we need for future work. However, the range of supported resources is still substantial enough to run a fairly substantial workloads. So speaking of workloads, here at the top of our table, we have some application workloads, which we wrap at a coarse granularity of transaction. And at the bottom, we have some micro benchmarks, which we describe more in the paper, in which each phase of the micro benchmark is wrapped in a transaction. So one of our first motivating examples was transactional software install. So we wrapped both the dpackage installer and a make install SVN in a transaction, which includes things like forking new processes, sending signals, and writing the file system. And for dpackage, the overhead was 10%, and for a make install of subversion, it was 70%. Now, for this 10 or 70% overhead, system transactions provide you with properties such as automatic rollback from failed install, leading to current operations on the same system undisturbed, and recovery from system crashes, all with no modification to these installers. Now, to establish a general trend, we have some other benchmarks here in the paper. And this trend is that overall, the overhead of using transactions ranges between 1 and 2x. Now, in addition to execution time, the other overhead to consider in a system like this is the overhead in terms of memory utilization, because we're tracking both old versions of data as well as new ones. So we looked at the LFS large benchmark, and for high memory, which is where IO pages are buffered, as well as application state lives, the overhead is 13%. For low memory, which is where kernel state is allocated, the overhead is 5%. So to answer our first question, transactions have reasonable performance and memory overheads. Now, a nice property of this design, as it turns out, is that we get some very dramatic write-up improvements on write-intensive workloads. So here we have five different micro benchmarks that all show improved performance improvements between 1.7 and 20x over unmodified Linux. Now, if the fact that there are five of these up on the screen isn't enough to convince you that we're not just getting lucky, we did some investigation into this trend. And as it turns out, what's going on is the transaction boundaries are providing very effective I.O. scheduling hints to the operating system. So within a transaction, the hot pages are essentially pinned in memory, and when the transaction commits, they're all written to disk in one sweep of the disk arm, yielding very effective utilization. Now, this isn't something we set out to improve when we designed the system, but it turns out to be a nice benefit. Finally, we motivated this work by using transactions as a lightweight database alternative. To evaluate this claim, we took the Open LDAP directory server and we replaced its Berkeley DB backend with transactions operating on flat files. Commensurate with the previous slide, for write-intensive workloads, we had speedups between 2 and 4x. Unlike the previous slide, however, this is a real-world workload and not just a micro benchmark. In the read-only cases, the performance was comparable either way because both implementations got a lot of benefit from using in-memory caching, and the performance wasn't sensitive to system call overheads. So we've seen several examples here of how transactions can be used profitably by applications. So now let's turn to the second question, the cost imposed by non-transactional applications. So to measure this, we took a non-transactional compiled Linux kernel, ran on Texas, and the overhead was less than 2%. Now, this is what we think will be representative of most applications running on our system. Now, we also looked at the worst-case scenario, which is the overhead of a single system call. And in our implementation, the overhead was 42%. Now, a big chunk of this 42% is attributable to the fact that we had one implementation for both transactional and non-transactional system calls that scattered with a lot of dynamic checks. If we were to compile these two things separately, we could drop these overheads substantially. So we measure this by turning these dynamic checks into static ones and measuring the non-transactional case on our system, in which the overhead is 14%. We think this 14% overhead number represents a mature implementation of system transactions on a system like Linux. Now, before we draw too many conclusions about this 14% number, let's put it in a little bit of context. So what we did is we measured these same system call micro benchmark on the Linux kernel, starting with the version we forked to make Texas 2 years ago, all the way down to the latest stable release as of last month. Now, as it turns out, over the last 2 years, feature creep in the kernel has cost an average of 16% for your system call overheads. So this tells me two things. First of all, developers are willing to give up modest amounts of performance to get features that make the system more usable. Secondly, transactions are in the same neighborhood, but a huge step forward. So in conclusion, operating systems should be supporting transactions, because as we've shown you today, there are practical implementation techniques on a modern OS, and they can be used to solve long-standing problems in existing applications and build better applications going forward. Thank you.
Okay, how about in the back left there?
Hello, hi. You're now from ACSD Research. So this is really interesting work. I really like it. So the question I have is that some of the resources that an operating system manages are not inherently transactional. For example, if you have a socket, you send a packet, and you can't just undo that, right? So I'm wondering how to help the application users to write a transactional code to be aware of these kind of situations.
Okay, so this is a fair question. He was asking about resources such as dealing with the network transaction. And there are a couple of different approaches that we can take, but it deserves some careful consideration, which is why I put it off to related work. One thing you could do is you can just buffer output until the transaction committed and then send packets. This will work in some cases it's not going to be the right fit. The other thing you can do is you can use a transaction aware network protocol, because after all, there are a lot of distributed systems that are developed with transactional semantics in mind that can sort of integrate with a system like this. But so that we don't get a bloated API, we wanted to put a little more careful consideration in the right thing to do.
Right for the university. I really like this word too. It's cool.
Thank you. Great question.
There's one big issue. So you alluded to a number of times the problem of big transactions. And clearly, big transaction view, big transaction seems to be a goal. And it's nice that you have a choice of either excluding other non-transactional activities or other smaller transactions to be locking, or just rolling back. But is are either of the choices you have necessarily good ones? If you're in the middle of a big transaction and there's some tension, are you likely to get in a situation where something, if you keep making one choice, you keep having to roll back, or you try to exclude everything? Is that a risk of one user DOSing another user by locking some shared shared state and doing an infinitely long transaction or something?
Sure, great question. So what he's asking about is essentially arbitrating sort of fairness between long-running transactions and maybe other resources, and the risk of DOS. And this is the problem that has to be architected and managed in any transactional implementation, including databases. And ultimately, it's kind of a policy issue, right? Like, how long do you want to let a transaction run before, maybe it's run too long, or do you want to favor a long-running or a short-running transaction? So what we do in Texas is we try to provide this scheduler with as many options as it can so they can enforce the right policy that the user desires. And that's one of the key innovations in our work.
Hi, Bill Lasky from Microsoft Research. I'd like you to compare this to the, at least to me, seemingly very similar support that shipped in Windows Vista.
Sure. So in Windows, you've got a kernel transaction manager, right? It's essentially a framework for two-phase commit among both the transactional file system and the registry and perhaps applications. So, one key difference here is that in Texas, we try to centralize as much of the, or reuse and share as much of the implementation as possible, whereas the implementation for like NTFS is sort of its own thing that uses in place of these, whereas the registry uses private copies. And if you wanted to say, the phase change memory file system transaction, you'd essentially have to start over from scratch. So that's one difference. Another thing is that the Windows programming model requires explicitly transacted code, right? And this is, in some sense, a more conservative design choice, because essentially they don't want developers doing things like, I typed xbegin format C and didn't roll back. So this makes sense. But what Texas is trying to do is push the state of the art in terms of having implicit transactions that can wrap larger chunks of code. A drawback of the explicit transacted code is that you can't do things on Windows like write a new script and then execute it in the same transaction. What?
Right. The motivating scenario for the transaction support in Windows was the exact same.
The soft stuff
that you did.
Yeah, but
it was going to be in the balance of the install package that you just wrap the whole application execution.
So Windows transactions can wrap a series of disk writes in a transaction, but you can't. I checked with the architect. You can write a post install script and execute it in the same.
Okay, let's move on to the next question.
Hi, this is Lynn from Central University. We talked offline last night, and basically I have one more question that I've been stewing on I'd like to throw your way. First of all, just to add to what Bill Lossi was saying, is your EHT3 implementation is kind of a cop-out, because you're implementing no-steal transactions, and EHT3 is no-steal read-only transaction process, and so it's kind of a perfect fit. If you had to do undo re-logging with steal transactions, you would find yourself making massive modifications to EHT3 as well. But that's what I'm really more interested in is the motivation. So we have been doing transactional work with Sunbird for a while, and one thing thing that keeps coming back to us is the motivation. We've been saying the same thing. Top two application install, but we were saying in 2004. So I guess my question is, with kernels getting smaller and people relying more on user-level databases, which you do not roll back, you ask them to take care of, their page caches and such, where do you see this system in 24 years, which is how long since SASP 85?
Okay, well, first of all, I hope there's some bright young grad students citing me and making things better. And maybe, too, someone in the room would like to throw me a few million in venture capital to keep this idea going. I think your specific question was about user-level managed databases, and, it's not entirely clear, I guess I'm not super familiar with exactly what the sort of trade-off between the system and the I/O portion of the kernel is, right? So I think that, there might be some changes based on the characteristics, but I think it's a fundamental point that I think this is the right design for the constraints of an operating system.
Sorry, I don't think we have time for any more questions, but please thank the speaker.